Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome into another edition of the Future Sox Roundup. My name is Elijah Evans, joined by my co-host Dylan Barnes. We're back. We're not live today. We're not going to be live for a couple weeks here. I'm starting a month in Europe right now. Dylan is back at school, so we're both kind of just settling back into our new situations right now. So we're going to be pre-recorded here for a couple of weeks, but we're still going to bring you all the content you need. And as always, I hope everyone knows you're always welcome to drop questions to either of us or the Future Sox page on X, and we'll definitely try to incorporate some thoughts, some questions, some ideas into the episodes, which we're going to do today with our main segment. But before we get into all of that, Dylan, what's going on with you, man?
I'm good. I'm glad to be back at school. It was nice to be home for a summer, but you know, after being away at college, you sort of get used to that, and it's gonna be fun to be back going to school, going to football games. Season starts in like a couple weeks, which is crazy because it's still like 95 degrees outside, which it's not fun going to football games in 95 degree weather. But anyways, White Sox they've had their fair share of rough patches recently. You know, it wasn't going to be the 10-4 after the All-Star break. That wasn't going to sustain the entire rest of the year. But I also don't think that the 2-11 since that date?
Yeah.
Something like that. I think you're going to find the middle ground between those two, and that's going to be around the team for the rest of the season. Like it's going to be stretches of good baseball, stretches of bad baseball, but I think you can balance it out and call them a 500 team for the rest of the way.
Right. While I love the transition, I have to back up 1 second before we dive into that. Okay. Mizzou record prediction for this football season.
Ooh, okay. Okay. So if I was going to be really, really crazy, I would say 11-1 with a loss to Alabama. That is our only loss. But I'm going to be a bit realistic. I'm going to say 9-3 with losses to Bama, Auburn, and I think we drop either one of the A&M or Oklahoma games.
Still a very good season, I would say.
We're a decent team, but the only game I care about is beating the university that is west of us, Kansas. As long as we beat them, we could go 1-11, and I don't care.
All right. Sounds good. You heard it here, folks. If anybody else cares about Mizzou football like Dylan does, you got the prediction on record.
I doubt it. Yeah.
Back into the White Sox. I'm completely with you there. I think we're on the same page with the fact that I think there is that middle ground coming. I think we're going to see a very balanced September. I think this team's going to play a tick below 500 ball in September. I really do. I think you're going to get a few more young guys in. You're going to see a little bit more fresh arms. The tough thing with the White Sox is you've got a lot of pitchers that are just at their kind of end here in terms of what they've got left. There's a lot of guys who are in their first professional season or, you know, their first season fully starting or whatever it is. Like there's just a lack of like innings durability, I think. And the White Sox know the position they're in. And I think that has led to a situation where they're prioritizing the innings limits over the results on the field, because ultimately this is about next year and it's about this growing period and it's about seeing what you can get to come next season. And what that comes with is needing to protect some of these young pitchers.
Yeah. And you know, that's what we saw with Sean Burke. You know, he got sent down, I believe it was Saturday, or it was either Saturday or Sunday. But then, you know, he gets sent down. Yoandris Gomez gets called, or sorry, it was Owen White gets called up. He is going to be, I don't know. I actually don't know if Owen White's going to stick around after last night. But Owen White gets called up to take Sean Burke's spot I would assume that Yoandris Gomez is taking his spot in the rotation, and then White is shifting into the bullpen.
Well, Yoandris Gomez took the Cannon spot. So there's going to have to be another.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. So
there, but
that is interesting, because if I'm not sure what they're going to go with, because if Martin Perez is back and healthy,
I think it's Perez probably. That seems what it seems like the indications there, which makes it a pretty somewhat gross bullpen there. The season with you're basically going into at least the next few weeks looking at Martin, Smith on an innings limit, Savali, Perez, Gomez, a little funky. But again, it's about the innings protection. I think with Burke. Like I've said this a couple times, and I think people don't love the still developing command. And that's why it becomes frustrating with Burke, because the command goes from, he has these kind of swings of, gets in a stretch of some walking guys. And then he gets in a swing of giving up some homers because he's trying to find the middle and he just gives the fastball up towards the middle too much. So it is a bit frustrating to watch Burke at times, but I really do think the stuff is getting there. And I think he's come a long way as a pitcher this season. You see a lot of spurts of like, okay, this guy can be a legit rotation piece. You see some spurts where he can't find the zone well, but I think there's that middle ground, like we said, with the White Sox in general. I think that's coming with Sean Burke. I really do. I still think when you look at the season as a whole, it's not at all like a failure of a season by any means. I think that, you know, especially the past couple of months, like really you take out April and he's been a pretty decent mid-rotation starter. It hasn't been excellent. There's definitely some things to work on. But I think if you remove like his first handful of starts, I think, so if I went back a little, I did this a couple of weeks ago. So taking out April entirely, if you take Sean Burke from the beginning of May through when he just was optioned, and you know, this last start was, the last couple starts were a little bit rough too. The innings just built up on him. But even if you include that and you literally just go from May 1st until he just got optioned, it's a 3.77 ERA with almost 9 strikeouts per 9. The walk rate's still higher than you want it to be, but it's still a big league arm and a big league rotation arm. Honestly, it's a 23% strikeout rate with a 10% walk rate. That's livable. And I do think that walk rate will come down. You've seen the strikeout rate tick up a lot in the second half of the season. The stuff is playing up a lot. You know, both the curveball and the slider have ticked up in noticeable margins. Also, he's giving up a 300 BABIP. Like, that's going to come down. That's higher than it should be, right? So you got a guy in Burke who I still really see as like a true quality four starter. And I think now you just got to protect his innings, because he's never been even near this amount of innings in his career.
Yeah, you sort of hit the nail on the head right there. I mean, Burke is at 117 and two-thirds innings pitched at a 4.28 ERA in his age 25 season, and for only have throwing, let's count up. He threw 7 innings in AAA in 2022, 36.2 in AAA innings.
And he was hurt that whole season in 23, for the record.
Exactly,
too.
Yes.
Never healthy that season.
In 23, those were the only 36.2 innings he threw at all. Yep. And then last year in 2024, threw 64.1 innings. So it's around 107 AAA innings, and now he's already surpassed that in one season in the big leagues. So like, there's still a lot of room to grow for Burke, and he's still building up the innings, like we said. But like, the fact that he was able to get to 115, 117 innings this year is a great sign, because there's still so much room to grow from here. And I think this is the floor that you build off of for next year.
Right. And you can say the exact same thing for Shane Smith. Obviously a different profile, but I think it's the same type of thing where you look at Shane Smith as a whole, it's still 100 plus innings of 4 ERA ball, and was way better when his arm was fresh in the beginning of the season. Yeah. That's running a 23% strikeout rate for Shane Smith, a 10% walk rate for Shane Smith, right? So it's very similar numbers, weirdly enough, even though Smith is, it's kind of been the opposite inverse, where Smith has struggled lately, Burke has gotten better lately, right? It's been a weird season for both these guys, but I do think both of them, you control their innings, you limit it, you take your time with them, and then these guys are both in your rotation next season, and you feel pretty good about that. I don't think either of these two profile as your ace, and that's where it becomes very important to see a couple of these guys in the minors take that next step, which we think they can. But I do think you at least have two 25-year-old pitchers who can be in your rotation next year, and after their first season of being a full-time starter, will be fresh, they'll be better come next season. And I see both these guys being, you know, mid to high 3 ERA guys, and those are guys you need that can churn innings and give you quality innings.
Yeah, and especially with both Smith and Burke, like, we've seen them go on stretches or starts where, you know, they're striking out 8-10 guys a game. And if they can get the command under control, but like, if they can just dial in and continue to just add polish, like, their stuff is going to take off and it's going to carry them. And, you know, I'm not going to say that they're going to be like a low 3 ERA guy, because like, it's going to be a bit volatile, especially with the command, because they're not going to be perfect. There's going to be days, you know, where it's the 2023 Sean Burke and he's all over the place, but you know, those guys can be valuable. And especially if they're your number three or number four starter, and then you've got Noah Schultz, Tanner McDougal, Hagan Smith, whoever, as the top of the rotation guys, like, that's perfect, especially coming from two 26 or 27 year olds.
Yeah, 100%. I'm with you there on that aspect. The other starter to mention, and I should have mentioned this earlier. We're going to get into kind of the future of the infield discussion here in a bit. I think that's going to be our main topic today, just talking through how to sort out the infield of the short-term and long-term future for the White Sox. Then we'll talk through some top performers of the week on the minor league side. The one more guy, a couple more guys I want to mention at the big league level, Yohandris Gomez, which we mentioned briefly earlier. He's two starts into his White Sox career, and I'm ready to see some more starts out of this guy for sure. I think that there's definitely some intrigue here. Yesterday, the stat line is a little bit misleading. Obviously, I wasn't watching this game because it was the middle of the night for me, but watching it back today through the condensed game, which is always the best, it was kind of just seeing that he just kind of lost it towards the end there. But it was four great innings for Gomez, and even into the fifth, and then he came out for the, whatever. It was the last inning and a half he pitched. He struggled. The command got away a little bit, gave up that homer late, but like, it easily could have been, a one-run, five-inning outing for Gomez, and called it at that, and that would have looked like two five-run, one-inning, or five-inning, one-run games in a row, right, before that last homer. This is a guy who has shown enough to give me reason to kind of have him as a consideration going into next season, and at the very least, he's earned six more starts this season to see what he can do at the big league level.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you're looking at a 25-year-old who, after his first two big league starts, has looked very good in both of them. I'll say that. And, like, I'm not going to say that he's like the Sean Burke of this year, where, Burke debuted last year and threw to like a 1.4 ERA. But, like, if he can carve out a rotation spot this year and then go into next year as the starting pitcher four, like, that's perfectly fine. Yeah. Because, again, he's still very young. He does not have much starting big league, or at least big league starting experience. So, I mean, Yoenders Gomez has got good stuff. Like, he threw a sweeper last night at like 85 miles an hour. It had positive 9 inches of induced vertical break and 14 inches of horizontal at 85 miles an hour. Like, that is a crazy good sweeper. So I've been very impressed by Gomez so far.
Yeah, I mean, the mix is fun. I still probably see it more as a reliever personally than I see it as like a long-term starter. And that's not a knock on him. That's just kind of like, that's fine. I think if he can be a piece at all for this team, right? You got him on waivers, right? So it's a positive get for the White Sox, regardless of what exact role he plays into. But the arsenal's fun, man. You've got a pretty good riding fastball with some good tail to it. You mentioned that sweeper, obviously, which has significant rides on it. He keeps blending stuff too. Like, he's got the more of the dropping kind of, it's tagged as a cutter, but it's interesting that I feel like his cutter is getting tagged, or his slider more is getting tagged as a cutter, because it has a lot of drop on it. It's an interesting mix there in general. I'm looking right now just at his movement profiles this year from on the season, and the cutter is listed at 13 inches of break and 10 inches of drop, which is interesting. Or that's the curveball. Pardon me. No, you're wrong. I'm wrong. Sorry. That's the curveball there. I'm mixing up my pitches here looking at charts. But the curveball, the sinker, then he mixes the cutter, then the changeup here and there, right? It's six pitches, and he's even flashed a slider, which I don't remember even seeing him throw a slider, but it's six pitch mix there with, multiple breaking balls, multiple fastball variations. He's just a guy who can mix and match and just kind of continue to throw things at you and keep you off your hands a little bit. And I do think that Gomez could be someone who develops into a piece. I want to see him in the rotation for the rest of the year for sure.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen a lot of the sort of like cut fastball guys get developed into the org, especially recently with the draft. But I mean, this sort of like arsenal development is what those guys can do. Like, you've seen guys like Davis Martin. I'm not going to say that he's like a candidate for a six pitch arsenal or whatever, but like, before he had the kick changeup, he was essentially basically fastball, slider, curveball. Like, that was it. Like, that was all he could throw. But then, he adds the changeup, and then he adds the cutter, and now his arsenal is sort of taken off from there. But like, Yoenders Gomez, I think, is only the start of the overall pitching landscape for the White Sox, because, I mean, I'm not sure what pitches he threw when he was strictly a reliever, but I can't imagine he had a six-pitch mix as a reliever. So I think that there's some sort of There's going to be some pitchers that are adding pitches this offseason and into next year. And I think it's going to be a lot of the big arsenal pitchers where, you know, you can move the ball all over the place and it's different looks.
Yeah. The only thing that I kind of have the reservations there with is I do feel like there's a lot of guys that can be a piece, and I'm a little concerned about guys being the piece, right? Like there is that kind of like, I'm sort of struggling to see the vision for any of the key pieces. And I still think Schultz can be that guy. And I still think there's a chance that the McDougal or Hagen can be that guy, but I am struggling to see a little bit of like the highest end upside for some of these arms. I think there's a lot of arms. There's a depth of arms. Where that becomes interesting is you do need a couple of those arms to be those star arms, right? So does that mean Grant Taylor transitioning to being a starter, or does that mean Grant Taylor is your superstar closer? Like that's the, you know, interesting, right? And does it mean, you know, can Schultz still be that one, or is he more of a three, right? Like that's where these questions come into play. And I think that generally speaking, there's a lot of arms and a lot of arms to be excited about, but you do want to see some of those guys kind of take a step into a higher tier. And none of these guys we mentioned necessarily are those candidates, but that doesn't mean they couldn't just show up and kind of take a huge step forward. So there's still a lot to be seen there. Should we switch gears over to the infield side of things?
Yep. I'm all good here.
Yeah. So the White Sox, for the first time in a while, have a little bit of a crowded infield, man. I mean, it's really interesting because if you looked at the infield coming into, you know, last year, even entering 24, it was like, oh, you've got Colson Montgomery, very exciting. You maybe have a Brian Ramos, and then you've got some
Jose Rodriguez.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's a flash from the past. Yeah. Right. So since then, right, Miguel Vargas comes over last year, becomes pretty clear he wasn't going to stick in the outfield. He transitions to be more of a corners guy. Started playing third. This year has pushed into more first, just kind of situationally, right? But he's going to be more of your corners guy. Colson Montgomery, obviously going to be a piece. We know we've seen the upside, right? You've seen him slow down a bit lately, but you still have seen the excitement there. He's going to be starting every day next season. Shortstop could be third if the situation depends it, but I do still think the plan for him is to be a shortstop. Then you go to Lenin Sosa. Lenin Sosa is Barry Bonds in the past 2 months. I mean, legitimately, Lenin Sosa has been the best hitter on this team when you really look at it, honestly. And you have to say, it's shocking. I was the Lenin guy 3-4 years ago in the minors. Yeah. And then the last 2 years, I've kind of been wavered off of it a little bit. But he is doing his thing, man. And he really doesn't have a true home defensively. He's naturally a second baseman. That's probably where he fits best. But then you've got Chase Meidroth, who's more of a middles guy, right? He's probably best at second. He can play short, but he is best suited at second base. You go over to Curtis Mead. Curtis Mead has played some first, probably best at second. Also, another guy who's probably best at second, could play some first, can play some third. Who knows? Just acquired, right? So it's still kind of you're figuring out what his role is going forward. And that's just the start of it, man. I mean, that really is. That the crazy thing there is I just mentioned, what, five, six guys who, you know, need hitting at the big league level. Then you go down and you consider Brian Ramos is still hitting it really well. He's still a natural third baseman, right? You go further down in the system. Sam Antonacci has been incredible this season. That's another infielder you've got in the mix. William Bergoya has been very solid at the double-A level, only 20 years old still. That's a guy who's played only for shortstop and second base to this point. Haral Perez, we're going to mention a little more later, has been excellent lately at the plate. That's a guy who probably only can play second base long-term when you look at the profile there for Haral Perez. That's just the start of it, man. You get down even further, and you know, obviously you've got Caleb Bonimer and Kyle, you know, the new draft picks and Billy Carlson, Kyle Odis, right? There's a lot of guys. You don't have to worry about that necessarily as much right now. But when you look and take a sec just at this organization infield-wise going forward, it's a little tricky to figure out how you're going to get these guys' innings and who you're going to end up prioritizing over other guys. Where do you stand kind of with the current guys in the big league roster? And then we can dive into more of the depth throughout.
I think that the best way to use the current guys that are on the roster. So like, I'm not including a Brian Ramos or a Tim Elko because, you know, we would want to see them, you know, at least get a chance to prove what they can do for just a little bit more of a period of time. But I think I would have to go Miguel Vargas at first base. Probably Chase Meidroth at second, Colson Montgomery at third, or at short, excuse me. And then I think, this is where it gets tough because Lenin Sosa really, like, I don't want to say he can't play anywhere because I mean, we've seen the first base experiment.
Second, though, I where I lean with that is just I don't right now. I feel like Lenin Sosa is more of an option at second base than Chase Meidroth, and that's tough.
Yes,
I like Chase Meidroth, but I do think you're getting more from Lenin. So if you're not going to trade, I think there's the whole aspect of trading too, because you definitely could look into selling high on Lenin, or you could sell the upside of Meidroth potentially. There's a lot of routes you can go here. If you're not trading anybody, I personally at this point I'm giving an edge to Sosa over Meidroth at second.
I can agree with that, but I will also say that if you want to go the defensive route, and you know, you just you can sacrifice a little bit of offense for better defense, Meidroth is better than Sosa at second base only. And then maybe you can move a Sosa to first base and Vargas back to third, but maybe I'm not sure. I think what I would go is Sosa at first, Chase at second, Montgomery at short, and then Vargas at third. So
yeah, and I'm not against that either. I think you, like, I'm looking at this more as next year, right? Like, I think this year ultimately you're just gonna make a match with you and you're gonna see what happens, right? I think the tricky thing comes, like, it really comes down to, like, who do you think is an everyday starter and who is legitimately an everyday guy? Because Colson Montgomery is going to get the chance to be an everyday guy for sure next season, right? I think if you're not trading him, you got to kind of have Sosa in there most days. Same thing with Vargas, right? So then it's like, is Meidroth an everyday guy, or is Mead an everyday guy, or is neither an everyday guy? Then you get to the system, right? Like, I think that the good thing, the slight luxury you have with this infield position is you don't have to think about anyone other than Antonacci really when it comes to next season. I still think Bergoglio being 20 years old, like, you can give him more time. Raul Perez probably gets to Birmingham next year, but I don't think either of those guys need to debut next year unless they really push the agenda. Even Kyle Odis, I think you're probably looking at 2027 as the timing for him. So I don't think there's any of those guys that necessarily are going to be in the MLB picture next year, but it wouldn't shock me.
What about a Ryan Gallany? Because he could carve out a spot at third base. Right?
We talked about him. I think Laney's another one. And Tim Elko, who we haven't mentioned yet, who I know people are clamoring to get him more at bats because he's raking in AAA, right? So it's tricky, man. But again, like, all of those pieces, like, who is an everyday piece? And that's why, even with a crowded infield, I'm still in the camp of signing a corner in the offseason, because I do think that you're in a position where you can afford to sign a big bat for the infield. And then just, you got to move off some guys. If it means trading a couple guys, okay, so be it. Like, you're going to have to move off some guys eventually. You're not going to be able to roll out this entire, all these names we just mentioned on a regular basis. So if you're not rolling them out on a regular basis, shouldn't you just try for the true pure offensive upgrade and get a guy who you know will be offensively worth playing every day, and then move off a few of these guys or make a couple of these guys more of utility players at that point? I still lean the route of signing an infielder, because then you can kind of mesh the rest of your infield around whatever the signing is. I think Gino Suarez is the perfect case guy. That's the guy I've kind of had penciled on my thing for a while, where the White Sox can maybe play ball to sign him for the money that he's going to be worth. And it would be a shorter term deal, so you don't have to worry as much about the Bonnemer and Carlson aspect of this, right? Because those are the guys you're hoping can be those higher end players, right? And really consume a spot. So if you can get a Gino Suarez on a 2 to 3 year deal, and then you have a fun situation where you can kind of have him and Vargas be your corners. If it means they switch off, if it means Gino slides to first sometimes as he ages, if it means Gino just completely takes over third and Vargas plays first, cool. Then you've got Colson at short, and then your second base, you can figure out from there, whether it's Lenin or a combination of Lenin, Meidroth, Mead, whoever they deem is the person who they trust the most there can get most of the reps there. They could trade one of those three guys. They could have a platoon situation going on. Like, there's a lot you can play around with there. Or you go the route of signing a middle infielder and shifting everything the opposite direction from there. There's a lot of possibilities here, man.
Yeah, and I just can't wait for the day when both Billy Carlson and Caleb Bonnemer are ready, and then we've got to do this whole thing again, but with shortstop, and then, you know, we're debating who's the better defender between Colson Montgomery and Caleb Bonnemer, and who's going to move to first. Like, that day is going to be really fun, and probably, what, 2028?
I hope we get there, man. I hope it goes well where both those guys are in that position. So
yeah. But yeah, I think that the best way, if you're going to sign an infielder, I think that the best way to do it is like a Gino Suarez, a Josh Naylor, a corner bat, which, you know, I'm not the biggest Josh Naylor fan. I don't think any White Sox fan is, but I'm talking about I'm talking about just his overall play style. Like, I hate Josh Naylor when he's playing the White Sox, but in terms of like signing him, I would prefer a, like you said, a Gino Suarez type player. But, you know, if you do end up signing that middle infielder, like a Bo Bichette, Jorge Polanco, whoever, you know, it could make a lot of sense, because then, you know, you have a, I don't want to say like a backup of second baseman that you can try and trade for other positions, but like, then you've got like a Mydroff becomes expendable, a Mead becomes expendable, even Lenin Sosa becomes expendable if you're not playing him at first. So there's a lot of ways that you can trade from the depth of talent that you have to improve the team elsewhere. And I think that we might see that in the offseason this year, especially on the infield side.
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be a move of some sort, whenever it may come. And then you got the aspect of Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro, who I still want to see playing every day. So then that takes the DH out. Yeah. It just becomes tricky there, because then it's like, okay, you have too many infielders, one can DH. Then you're only playing your young catchers half the days. So like, even if it's not 100% of days, you still need X amount of days in a week for the DH spot to go to one of the catchers, right? So then it's like, okay, yeah, you've got 3 days a week to play with a DH, to add and Sosa's bat in there, to add, you know, someone's bat in there via a different way. Like, it's going to get tricky, and I'm curious to see what happens. And then you have the aspect of Sam Antonacci, who I just don't see why Sam Antonacci couldn't just completely take over the second base job. Honestly, like, I think there's a world where with all these guys competing, come mid next season, he might just look like the best option there, and all these guys fall to the side because Antonacci just forces the agenda. Maybe I'm a little bullish there, probably. I'm not sure it quite goes like that. Maybe it's not till 2027 when Antonacci really pushes it, but I think there's a very much a possibility that he could push for regular innings at second base next season, which then forces other guys to find time elsewhere even more. So the last angle of this is like, can any shift to the outfield? Do you see anybody in the system, any of these young guys who could be outfielders? Because long-term, that would be helpful. Short-term, I don't even know if that helps, because you, at this point, you have, unless you're trading them, unless you're cashing in the offseason, you've got Benintendi, Robert, and Tauchman all set in the outfield. So like, that's where it's, and like, all of them are hitting right now. Like, all three of those guys have been hitting pretty well of late, for sure. And like, they're all, so it's like, even if you have, oh, okay, this guy can play left field next season, left field's not open. Oh, this guy can try center field. Center field's not open right now. So I don't know.
I think that the only one that could really handle a switch to the outfield and could be serviceable is Sam Antonacci, because pretty much everybody else, they've got, you know, their flaws. It's whether it be a weak arm, they're not that quick on their feet. I think Sam Antonacci is sort of like the perfectly, I don't want to say average at both, but like, he's got a strong enough arm. He's quick enough. And he's going to steal probably 50 bases this year. Like, he can probably shift to the outfield and be just fine. Like, I'm not going to expect him to be, you know, a gold glove left fielder or whatever, but like, we've seen time and time again, the athletic middle infielder shift into the outfield and become serviceable. Like, Fernando Tatis Jr. was the worst defensive shortstop maybe I've ever seen. And then he wins a platinum glove 3 years later in right field. So there's something to be said about, you know, just getting these guys into the outfield and letting them trust their instincts and just being a good fielder.
Yeah. My question is, what does that look like for Antonacci? Because I don't disagree with you. I think he's the most logical. I don't see Bregoia fitting in the outfield. I don't see Perez fitting in the outfield. Mm-hmm. You're not moving Bonner or Carlson to the outfield anytime soon, if ever. Probably not ever for either of those guys, right? So then it's like, if it's Antonacci, which I'm open to the idea because I do think he could physically handle it. It's probably a corner, though. I don't think he has quite the range left for center. I kind of agree with you that I don't think he's the arm for right, probably. So it's probably left. So are you looking at a Benintendi trade? Is that kind of where your head is at? Because I'm pretty open to the idea of a Benintendi trade this offseason or next deadline, potentially, which either or kind of – because Benintendi, like, for all the hate that Benintendi got for the first year of his contract and whatever, like – when you look back at that contract and it's like, oh, I get, because it's the White Sox biggest deal ever, it looks bad, whatever, like blah, blah, blah. He's provided pretty good value now for the past year and a half, for the past year at least, like the past year and 2 months, right? Since last July, he's been a pretty good player at that value, honestly, and has been serviceable. And I do think that like, he would be a legit upgrade as a starting left fielder for many contending teams, like in the offseason or next deadline potentially.
And the further away you get from signing that contract, the more and more tradable right. it becomes, because there's what, like 2 years left after yeah. this year? So it's $30 million a year, or $30 million left on the deal. So like that's yeah. very tradable, especially for a guy yeah, with the
actually the dropped down too. It's interesting because it was lower the first year, and then it was $17 million last year, this year, and next year, and then 2027 it's only $15 million. So it's $17 and $15 million for 2 years yeah. of Benintendi. Like, I'm not saying it's an appealing contract, but it's not right, an yeah. appealing contract, right? It's not
exactly you can trade it if you wanted yes. to.
It's a movable deal. And then there's the Tauchman aspect, but I think with Tauchman, it's like, okay, if he's on the ARB next year and they didn't move him at the deadline for various reasons, if he's in your roster and he's, you know, still providing solid offensive production, then it's just the most simple Tauchman for Brady Montgomery swap of all time.
Exactly.
Come the deadline next year. Like that one seems very like layup-y, and maybe that's underthinking it, but like that feels to me like a pretty clear layup of like Mike Tauchman's our right fielder until Brady Montgomery's ready. When Brady Montgomery's ready, Brady Montgomery's our right fielder. Like it kind of feels that simple. Maybe it's not that simple. Maybe there's still hope that Montgomery could be in center instead of Robert eventually. But I do think at least in the next year outlook, it's a pretty clear just Montgomery, when he's ready, slots into right field and Tauchman gets traded. Like, I don't think it's that complicated. But
how would you feel about off-season Tauchman trade and then trying to push the envelope on a Braden Rookie of the Year and PPI pick for 2027 draft?
I got to see this. We're going to talk about this when we talk about in a few minutes, but I got to see a little bit longer of like true double A success. This week was awesome. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
Pensacola's pitching staff has also been a mess the past week or few months or two.
Yeah.
I'm not totally opposed to that, but I would need to see this season, like the next month, just continue to be an absolute heater for Braden. Like I still think there's a couple things he needs to get kind of a little bit more refined with. And he's definitely showing it lately, and that's great. And that can be, you know, we can talk about it right now. What did he just do this week? He posted it. He went 11 for 22,
11 for 22 with 8 doubles and 5 walks, raises OPS by 300 points.
Yeah. That tweet banged, by the way. Yeah. And that was, I mean, yes, like Brayden Montgomery, that's incredible to see. This is the week of Brayden Montgomery that allows you to see what Brayden Montgomery can be. I still think those doubles, though, need to be some homers. And that's not a knock on him at all. And I still think he will do that. But for Brayden Montgomery to be the piece that he doesn't need to be, but the piece that really makes him like the headliner of that trade, when you look at what Garrett Crochet is doing too, it needs to come in the form of power, because the White Sox need power. And I think Brayden Montgomery has that, but the loft, the keeping the whiff down while producing power for Brayden is still not fully there. And I think it will get there. But I need to see him get to the point where he is keeping the strikeout rate in check. He's taking his walks and he's turning some of those doubles into homers. And I do think part of that's Birmingham. I think he'll do that more when he gets to Charlotte, whenever that may be. Could be this season for sure. But I'm not quite ready for to say, yeah, opening day, let's do it, personally.
That makes 100%. That makes sense. But I will also say that, you know, if he is going on the stretch that he is, and, you know,
yes.
looking like this and carries it over into a good spring, I think that there's a legitimate option to be said where, you know, all right, you're going to be our right fielder at, what is it, 23, he'll be 23 years old next year.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's something to be said for the fact that this is only year two of him becoming a full-time batter. Like he was a two-way player at Stanford up until he transferred to Texas A&M for his last year at Texas A&M. That was his first year of not being a two-way player. So this is only year two of him focusing purely on hitting.
Good
so maybe there's another gear that he can tap into, especially this winter. So,
yeah, definitely a good point there. I'm with you on that front. I think there's reason to believe, you know, that could be sooner than later. But I am curious to see who gets moved. At some point, they're going to move one of Benintendi, Robert, and Tauchman, and probably two of them eventually are going to get traded, because I don't think at least, I mean, Robert could. If Robert really becomes his 2023 self, maybe he's long-term future again, and that everything we talked about for 2 years of him getting traded is just complete out of the window. But I don't even intend that'd be crazy. That would, I mean, it would honestly be sick, but it would be, I don't see him signing like an extension. Like, I see that as very unlikely, but like the world where he just like goes off in 2026, they say, screw it, let's make Robert our center fielder of the future. Like, who knows? There's a world.
Yeah, they give him like the exact same contract, like 480.
That would be really funny. But Benintendi and Tauchman, like, as good as they've been this season, and they've been the most consistent productive players on the team, I don't see either of them being part of this next contention window, which means at some point you're going to consider trading both those guys and then slotting in a Brandon Montgomery, maybe a Sam Antonacci, maybe an out, you know, a signing, right? I still am very open to an out, you know, a signing in the outfield as well, but the infield situation is just, it's just complicated. It really is. And it's going to be fascinating to see how it all works out, because there's a lot of guys and not innings for everyone. And that's just going to, you know, it's going to have to be somewhat of an earn it situation. And I'm kind of here for that. Like, that's a good thing. White Sox, like, having to earn positions for anybody is going to help. It is a good place to be in, because last year nobody was earning anything. Let's be honest. Right. Like, that wasn't the case, right? So earn it, like, go earn it. The next month and a half, the guys that are in this kind of, are you a starter in the infield or not? Like, let's see them earn it. And let's see, you know, guys like Antonacci push the agenda in the Arizona Fall League and in spring training, and then see guys at the big league level say, hey, I'm not going anywhere. Like, I'm still producing. Like, I want to see all of that. And Lenin Sosa is doing that more than anybody this year. Obviously he's proven that he's a big league piece. So we'll see how that all shakes out. That's kind of where we're at with the infield situation. Yeah, and then, you know, we'll continue to revisit this, because I can't wait to do like a once the season is over after the end of the regular season, I definitely want to dive into just a full free agent class breakdown, because the White Sox can spend a little. They have the ability to. I hope that the statements from Getz and the indications are true, because like it's not a great free agent market, but there's some clear guys that would really be an upgrade for this team and could fit in very well. And they just got to make that happen and see what they can get in the market. But for now, we'll take a little break on all the future spiraling, as much as we love doing that, and get into some minor league performances. And we already did Brady Montgomery, so we don't need to do that. But we can start in Charlotte, yeah?
Yeah. Tim Elko, an absolutely ridiculous, has had just a ridiculous August in general. So in the month of August, it's a 1027 OPS, 154 WRC plus. The strikeout rate is under 20%. It's a 12 strikeouts in 63 plate appearances. He's got 6 home runs in the month of August. You know, it's just more of the same from Tim Elko in Charlotte. And like, yeah, it's not been great in Chicago, but like, there's going to be times where, you know, Tim Elko gets called up because they need that extra corner infield spot. And, you know, if he can just be like that sort of bench bat, big time power guy, sure. Like, he was never going to be that, you know, core first baseman, but you know, it's been really fun to watch him just continue to kill the ball in Charlotte.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It's great to see. Like, I love it. I still have a hard time seeing it being a big league everyday role. I'm with you there. Like, I hope so. I would love to see it. And then it's just like, he's still part of that infield glut, right? Like, that's not like, there's not like, oh, it's just get Tim Elko in there every day, because like in theory, sure. But then it's that kind of pushes one of Vargas or Sosa, unless you go with like Elko at first, Sosa at second, Vargas at third for the most of the season, but then you're pushing out both Meidroth and Mead in that scenario, right? So maybe he should come up in September. I think he's just hitting too well not to get a shot, but I don't know how you get him every day at bats. And I'm not sure a player of his archetype can develop at the big league level without every day at bats.
Right.
Even with everyday at bats, though, is it worth justifying those at bats when you have other guys who you also think can be a piece? That's where it comes down to. And I know everybody, a lot of people like to just look at it and say, he's raking, he should be getting everyday at bats. It's not quite that simple for Elko, because you're dedicating at bats to an archetype that's a lot riskier than maybe some of these other guys who you think have a better likelihood of sticking at the big league level.
Yeah, and you know, like it sucks, because I'm a huge Tim Elko fan. He is an absolute joy of a human, but you know, like you said, his type of player is going to need a lot of at bats at the big league level to be fully ironed out and get the chase and the whiff and all of that under control. And I'm not sure that the White Sox are going to be able to give it to him. You know, like we've been talking about the entire episode. The infield is very crowded, and you know, there's not very much room for a 26-year-old first baseman with, you know, yeah, he's got some of the best power on in the organization, but he's also got some of the most concerning whiff issues in the organization as well. So it's just, it's a give and take, but I'm really pulling for Tim because he's a absolute, he's a great person. He's a great guy.
Yeah. And that brings you to the next guy in Brian Ramos, who like is another guy that like you, I would like to see him get some big league at bats. Yeah. I think he's earned the right to get some big league at bats. It still is just hard to find it, you know, time for him. Brian Ramos since the, for the last month and a half. So since August, I'm running this since July 8th. In that span, so the, you know, 6 weeks of games for Ramos there, it's an 896 OPS with a 123 WRC plus, seven homers in that span. The strikeout rate's about 22. The walk rate's up to 8.5% in that time. So Brian Ramos in that range has been, has shown enough to be a big league piece. It's just, where do you play him? Where do you get Brian Ramos innings? Where do you get Tomelco innings? Like, I really don't know. Both these guys have been great, though. Honestly, you got to give them their props because Ramos, in what has been a tough season for him, dealing with a couple injuries, just really never finding his groove early in the year, in July and August has been everything that Brian Ramos was kind of touted to be, honestly, at the AAA level, at least.
Yeah, and you know, we've said it time and time again. Like, Brian Ramos is a streaky hitter, and you know, when he gets into these streaks that he's on, he's going to be one of the most fun players to watch in the organization. But, you know, dealt with injuries and again, the massive just depth in the infield, like it's going to be tough for him to carve out a spot. But, you know, when he's on, he's very, very fun, but you just have to sustain that hot streak for 2-3 months instead of only it being like 2-3 weeks. So I'm still not out on Brian Ramos because I mean, we've seen what he can do at in the minors and even in the majors. Like, he had a solid showing last year, but I just want to see it over a longer stretch of time. Like, it can't just be a 2 week flash and then you go back. So that's where I'm kind of at.
It's a little tricky to just kind of figure out what that's even going to look like for him. So I'm not sure what it's going to be for him going forward. But the next guy up in AAA, the last guy to discuss from Charlotte, for me at least, is Will Robertson. And this is the guy who Will Robertson, you know, speaking of guys who could get some innings, like Will Robertson in Charlotte has been very good since coming over to – when did he come over? I think he came over in
– I want to say like June?
Yeah, it was like he's played 20 games in Charlotte now, right? So it's only been 20 games in Charlotte and then, you know, a handful of games in Chicago, but not enough to get any sort of run there at all. 20 games in Charlotte, Will Robertson has a 130 WRC plus. He's got a, you know, an OPS over 800, over 900 in that span, right? So he's been very solid in Charlotte. And everybody hits in Charlotte. I know that's kind of the stereotype there. And it is true to some extent, but Robertson's another guy who, like, I'd still rather see some Robertson innings than like Michael Taylor innings. And on the days where it's just Benintendi, Robert and Tauchman, right? Like, I still would rather him be a fourth outfielder. But I think there's, you know, reasons for him not to be up at this point. And I'm not sure there's much there from Robertson, but he has been very good, especially of late in Charlotte.
Yeah. You know, he got bought or purchased from Toronto, traded for cash considerations in July. Mm-hmm. And, you know, August hasn't been as good as the end of July for him. It's only a 771 OPS compared to a 1023 in July. But, you know, Robertson is another guy where, you know, it's just going to be tough to get him at bats because, I mean, it's crazy that we're having this sort of conversation for a team that's probably going to lose 100 games for the third straight year. But, like, there's not a lot of room for anybody.
And that's why these guys are in AAA, and you know they might just be more of AAA hitters, but all three of them have been mashing lately, and you know it's good to see, of course. But I'm curious to see who, if any of them, will get innings come you know September call ups potentially.
I think that Robertson will. This is actually a good topic of conversation. September call ups. Who do we think?
I mean, I think one has to be an arm just because the arms are so worn down. So I think they're going to run one arm up probably.
That makes sense.
Which would mean there'd be one hitter spot there. And then I think, yeah, Robertson or Ramos probably seems right. Elko could be too, though. I could see it being any of those three, honestly.
Yeah.
Probably a rotation of them maybe, or if somebody goes in the IL, two or three of them or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I would probably have to agree. Probably an arm and a bat. Maybe it could be Tanner McDougal. We don't know.
Yeah. No, that very much could be out of the bullpen at least. three arms to mention going down to Birmingham. So we focused on hitting in Charlotte. Birmingham's been you know, very good overall, but we've talked about Antonacci a lot. We've talked about Brandon Montgomery a lot. Focus more on the pitching side in Birmingham. The trio of Riley Gowans, Shane Murphy, and Tyler Schweitzer have all been very good lately. I had Shane on a podcast a couple weeks ago. Really, really cool to just hear his insights. Super smart pitcher, just the way he thinks through his pitching. Gowans is a guy who's had some ups and downs this year, but of late, his last five starts have been very solid, and he started to look a lot more like the kind of the spurts of Riley Gowans we saw last year, really dominate Double A at times, and has been doing that of late. And then Tyler Schweitzer, I want to give a shout out to there because, you know, he got up to Charlotte, got hit around a little. I think generally pitchability, soft throwing guys in Charlotte is like a recipe for disaster. Yeah. But Tyler Schweitzer is still reminding us that he's a very, very solid pitcher in Birmingham. It's just going to be interesting to see if and when he can make that transition back to Charlotte, what that looks like. But in his, I think, what is it, five outings or six outings for Birmingham, he hasn't given up a run yet. So he's thrown, yeah, I mean, this is ridiculous. He's thrown six outings of at least three innings with exactly two hits allowed in all six of his outings in Birmingham, and no runs in any of those games. So he just gives up a couple little hits and gets outs and just is doing that. Yeah. He's piggybacking guys out of the bullpen. He's been kind of the piggyback guy there in Birmingham. So curious to see Schweitzer bounce back. But all three of these guys have been very solid, and Birmingham as a whole has been excellent.
Yeah, you know, I've been really impressed by not only the Riley Gowans, but Shane Murphy is just like the best pitcher in the Southern League this year. So he leads the Southern League in ERA with a 1.52 ERA. If you had to guess who the second qualified pitcher in ERA was, what's their ERA? So his is a 1.52.
It's qualified is the issue, because I would have said Palish, yeah, honestly, but I don't think, yeah, Palish is qualified.
He's not qualified.
Right, so that's 1.52. It's Southern League. Southern League is good pitching, but I'm still thinking it's like a 2.3, 2.4.
2.43. It's almost a full run higher than what Shane Murphy's ERA is.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And it's over 100.2 innings, so like it's not just some flash in the pan, like, oh yeah, he's had a good 2 week stretch of games. No, like this is a full season of just getting guys out. Like he's not going to strike a ton of guys out. Yeah. But he just is just going to throw the ball where you're going to swing at it and you're going to roll it over to shortstop, or you're going to pop it up in foul territory. So it's been really fun to watch Shane Murphy start. And then Riley Gowans has put his name on the map in terms of like being a, I don't want to say the throwaway piece in the Aaron Bummer deal, but like not a lot of people. Lottery ticket. Yeah. But yeah, like he went from being sort of a name that not many people were really familiar with to now he's thrown, 105 innings of a 3.86 ERA in Double A, which, yeah, for a guy who you got, like, I'm forgetting how many innings he threw prior to coming over to the White Sox, but like that's very good. So I've been very pleased with Riley Gowans' development this year.
Yeah, definitely. He's coming to his own. I think it's a good depth guy to have in the system, and it's shown plenty of, you know, reason to think he could be a pretty solid pitcher. Moving on from that, we go to Winston. Not much of talking candy this week. We're going to finish out with Winston, and that'll be just about it for this time. The hitter to talk about is obviously Haral Perez. Has been on a run, man. I mean, he had that little, like, maybe he got hurt thing, and I was like, dang, he's killing his progress, like right in the middle of him getting hot. But no. He's totally fine. He's all good. It just has been really, really good, dude, for a decent amount of time now. It's not just like it's coming out of nowhere. Like, Haral's been mashing for a little while. Looking back just like the past, so like if you go to like the past month, let's say, so this is tracking back from the 18th to the 18th. I'm looking at just like from the last month from Haral Perez. He's hitting .316 in that period for a guy who was hitting two something most of the season. 881 OPS in that span, 156 WRC plus. The biggest thing for Haral Perez in the past month has been an identical walk rate and strikeout rate for this guy. Striking out at an 8% clip after striking out at a much higher clip for most of his professional career and most of the season, honestly. You know, on the year this year, it's 20%, but the last month it's 8% strikeout rate. Wall tapping into the power. You're seeing, you know, up to 19 homers on the year now. Harald's kind of mashing, dude. And he's looking like a guy who, you know, at 20 years old, he's going to turn 21 this offseason. Like, he'll be in Birmingham next year. And the position is tricky because it is probably limited to second base long term. But he can hit, man. And he's really tapping into that power for a small guy and at a very, very high level.
Yeah, I think I tweeted something about this the day that he hit his 19th, which you tweeted something about as well. If you had to guess the last time a White Sox player age 20 or younger had 20 home runs in the minor leagues, what year would you say?
Long time.
It was 2011. Trace Thompson. Yeah. In Kanapolis, or what Trace was Thompson, he in Kanapolis back then? I'm not even sure.
I'm not even sure it was. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean,
Regardless, it has been a while, and Haral Perez has just been really, really good this year. I mean, it's a 120 WRC plus, and the thing for me is, like, this is his first full year posting a BABIP under 310, and it's a 264. So, like, if he starts to get BABIP luck on his side, with the type of power that he has and the way that he's limiting strikeouts, especially recently, like, this is a very, very solid and complete hitter that I'm not sure that White Sox fans are putting a lot of stock into, just because he's a new guy in the system and they haven't heard him talked about much.
And because that trade was such a fleece, that's why.
Exactly. Yeah. It was awful and horrible. And it's just everybody from that trade can never pan out at all. Right. But like, it's a really fun profile.
He's been good. He really has been very, very good lately. And the biggest thing for him is, I think some of the swing decisions have been a little lackluster at times, especially last year. And now you're seeing this last month, he's not striking out, which is crazy. I don't expect it to stay at 8%, but even if he can find a home for that type of profile at 15% strikeout rate while he's elevating to the pull side as much as he's been doing, because like he just really knows how to get his pull side power, man. And that's something that I think more and more guys in the system need to be doing sometimes. Yes, you want to use the whole field, but when you're able to get into your pull side power and you can turn on fastballs, you got to do it. And he's been doing it at a really high level and air pulling, not just pulling, but getting it in the air. And that's part of why, you know, it's for him, it's like the fly ball rate is high, right? It's a 45% fly ball rate, which for generally speaking is very high. But when you're able to pull those down the line and take them out, right, that becomes a little more understandable for a fly ball rate to be that high. So I like a lot of what Harald's doing, and I think he's in a pretty good spot right now. The last two names to mention today in terms of just guys that are, you know, heating lately is a pair of relievers from last year's draft. And this duo in Winston has looked really, really good. The last month right now for Phil Fox, who was seventh round, correct me if I'm wrong, and then Jack Young, who was ninth round last year. So we had seventh and ninth round, you know, relief picks last year, in a way, like saving picks, right? There was a lot of relievers taken last year's draft to be able to sign the high-end guys like Caleb Bonimer early in the draft, right? The last month for Phil Fox and Jack Young. Phil Fox, 10 innings, no runs, three hits, no earned runs, three walks, 14 strikeouts. He also threw an immaculate inning this past week, which is sick. That's just awesome. And then Jack Young in that last month, it's 12.1 innings with two runs allowed, six hits, one walk, 12 strikeouts. These two have been shoving, man. And I honestly think there is a, you know, as college guys, older guys, Jack Young is 23. Phil Fox, I believe, is 22. And then those two, like, doing what they're doing at the high level out of the bullpen, it's not, you know, bullpen arms generally at the lower level minors are pretty little excitement there. And mostly guys who, you know, they really need to take a big step. These two should be in Birmingham soon, honestly. Jack Young, I know, started in Kanapolis, so maybe he'll stay in Winston. I'd be perfectly happy to see Phil Fox in Birmingham. And I don't think I'd be mad to see Jack Young there too. And I think that these guys going into next year are two of the more intriguing lower level guys in the bullpens.
Yeah. You know, I've said it from day one. Phil Fox is, he's a dude. Like the fastball qualities that he has, and just being able to get whiffs on a lower 90s fastball, but like the flat approach angle, and he's able to locate it above the letters. It's just a really intriguing profile. And, you know, you mentioned that the last month, I'll bump it back five innings more. 15 innings, his last 15 innings since July 8th. Six hits, two earned runs, both of them were on solo homers. Five walks, 21 strikeouts in 15 yeah. innings. So like it's just really fun stuff from Fox. And then Jack Young just is an uncomfortable of an at-bat as they come.
Yeah.
Like, he comes like almost, it's not so much submarine as it is like just true sidearm, but yeah. the slider that he has is like sweeping across area codes. Like it's coming from the shortstop. It's almost like a righty Noah Schultz slider where, you know, it's just darting across the strike zone. And granted, it's not as hard as Schultz's, but like it's just a very uncomfortable at bat, and you can see why he had like a, I think it was like a 0.3 ERA in Canny this year. So I've been very, yeah. very
pleased. He struggled with the first couple outings in Winston, and then immediately has yeah. bounced back for a really good couple weeks. So both these guys are just two relief names to keep an eye on, because you know we don't always give the most love to relief pitchers in the minor league level, but it's important to give that sometimes.
Relief pitchers matter.
Yeah, these two have been shoving for sure. So. Well, this is for a non-live edition. This was good stuff. We had a good time, and we'll definitely be back next week. I know Jeff is going to be out in Winston for a while this week. Make sure to check out some of the content he's got going there. He put up a bunch of videos with a lot of the new draft guys in Kannapolis last week. So make sure you check out at AAA Jeff for all of that content. Dylan is at Not Cease. I am at Elijah EV8. As always, we are part of the Just Baseball Media Network. We've got plenty of content coming up here. Hopefully some end of the season minor league content. Potentially I might head out to Arizona for some fall league content, because the White Sox fall league roster is loaded, and we're gonna have a lot more coming on the offseason, moves to be made, and all that such coming soon. Thanks, Dylan.
Thank you.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points, perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.